This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review. We're going to look at important events from around the world from this past week and put them in their prophetic context. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
And Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain.
Good afternoon.
This week, as we looked at the big events from around the world, a common theme came up in virtually every major story we looked at, and that is a man named Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. He is doing some remarkable things right now that we need to watch closely. This past Wednesday, Brad McDonald talked about this man on the Trumpet Daily Radio show. It really gave some important insight into him, into his history, into just some of the ruthlessness that he has exhibited over the years. It's a really good program to go and listen to. The United States tends to view Putin as maybe a bit of a troublemaker, or in some cases, a fairly respectable guy. The current administration handed over the issue of chemical weapons in Syria to Russia. The problems that are happening in Syria today, Washington is basically saying, well, you know, look, it looks like Russia is doing a pretty good job of taking care of the problem over there. And, of course, it's not just the current administration, as Mr. McDonald brought out. It was the last president, President George W. Bush, who infamously said, I looked into his eyes, I saw that this was a man that I could work with. But the truth is, he is a very dangerous, very ruthless individual, and he's making some phenomenally bold moves right now that are changing the world. He's redrawing the borders of some countries. He's causing nations all over to have to rethink alliances, to have to change military policy, to have to put a high priority on paying close attention to Russia. Well, on the show today, we're going to look at several areas where he is driving events. We're going to look at Syria and Iran and Saudi Arabia, the United States, even the Balkans and Germany and China. Very important developments in each of these areas that are all being driven by this man, this former KGB agent, who is a very canny man. And to start off the discussion, I just want to remind listeners of what the Trumpet's editor-in-chief has been saying about this man for over a decade. Back in our January 2004 edition, there had just been elections, parliamentary elections in Russia, where Putin's party secured a strong majority. It gave him massive control. This is what Gerald Fleury wrote at the time. Russian elections have recently moved President Vladimir Putin much closer to being a dictator. This strikes intense fear in Europe. The Europeans still remember how violent Russia was in World War II, and Russia is a close neighbor with massive piles of nuclear weapons. He said, a more dictatorial Russian government is coming fast, and you need to know where it is leading. That power will be able to challenge Europe when nobody else can, including the U.S. The whole world should be alarmed, he wrote. Mr. Putin was shaped and molded by the infamous KGB, Russia's ruthless, murderous secret service arm of the government made famous by Joseph Stalin. Obviously, people can change, but how often do we see people make truly radical changes in their lives? Has Mr. Putin now become a freedom-loving Democrat? Not likely. A new Russia has just been born, and Mr. Putin has staged his own coup. He's taken over this new Russia, and now the world has another major reason to tremble. That was 2004, January 2004 Trumpet edition. 2008, in August, Russia used military force to invade the former Soviet nation of Georgia. And this is what Gerald Fleury wrote in our October 2008 Trumpet issue. Russia's attack on Georgia in August marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more. And he actually asked, will a crisis occur over Ukraine? That area is the breadbasket of Russia, and certainly it is willing to wage war over that as well. Well, that's exactly what happened just a few years later. And when Putin did attack Ukraine, Mr. Fleury wrote this in the February 2014 issue, an article titled, "Is Vladimir Putin the Prophesied Prince of Rosh?" He wrote this, "Mr. Putin recently pushed the U.S. out of his backyard by pressuring Kyrgyzstan to kick America out of Manas Air Base, really important air base for the United States and our presence, really our major presence in Central Asia. He also convinced the Obama administration to back down over a missile defense shield America had planned to build in Europe." All of these incidents that were happening at that time that show just how aggressive, how powerful Putin was proving to be. Russia's deep involvement in the Middle East. Listen to this. This is February 2014. "Russia's deep involvement in the Middle East has allowed the brutal Syrian regime to retain power. It has also been instrumental in allowing Iran to continue pursuing nuclear weapons. Domestically, Putin has transformed the Russian media into a propaganda machine. He has severely curbed the power of democracy and emasculated Russia's parliament. Putin and his Kremlin cronies have used their political might to seize some of Russia's most lucrative companies. Under Putin's reign, nuclear-armed Russia is also transforming its military machine into a modern technological 21st century force. By all of these heavy-handed tactics, President Putin has not only brought Russia back into play as a world power, he has also secured his position at the nation's helm." And he's been saying, and he said in that article, it looks like Vladimir Putin will fulfill this specific biblical prophecy of a prince of Russia, a prince of Rosh, who's going to lead a massive Asian army in the time of the end. This is a powerful prophecy, very specific, and this is what he said about it. "Can you think of any other Russian politician who could become so powerful and have the will to lead Russia into the crisis of crises? I see nobody else on the horizon who could do that, and only a tiny few years remain for the Prince of Rosh to appear. Such a man doesn't appear overnight. It takes years for even a strong-willed leader to gain such control. Vladimir Putin already has the power and the will to use it." And this is what we're seeing. This is what we're going to talk about in the program today, get into several specific theaters where he is demonstrating that will. We're going to start with Brent and events in the Middle East, specifically in Syria.
Right. Well, today and yesterday, there has been the talks that have taken place in Vienna, Austria, over the Syrian crisis. Foreign ministers from about 20 nations are there. And this is the first time for that Iran has actually participated in these talks. They obviously have a big part to play in Syria, backing the Syrian regime. And Russia actually invited Iran to these meetings, and Iran accepted at the behest of Russia. So they are there as well. The United States obviously didn't want Iran to be there initially, but there they are. So at these talks, you've got two main power blocks. You've got Russia leading one of those, and Russia obviously supports the Assad regime. And with him, you have Iran. They want Assad to stay in power as well. And then also China is backing them. And then on the other side, the other power block, you have the United States. And then behind the United States are Western powers, as well as other Arab states, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, as well as Turkey. They want Assad to go. Now, what we're seeing looks like it's playing out of these talks is that Russia is completely in control. What we're even seeing, and as reported in our Trumpet Weekly this week, is that some of those Middle Eastern allies of the United States are actually turning to Russia, or they realize that if they want to get their will done, they have to actually go through Russia now. United States is not the broker for Middle Eastern peace. We have an article entitled, "The U.S. is Driving Middle East Allies Towards Putin," and this is from the Bloomberg View. And this is just its opening sentence. It says, "America's traditional Middle East allies, having run out of patience with President Barack Obama's policy in Syria, are now reaching out to a resurgent Russia, even though it's bolstering the very dictator so many of them have pushed to leave power." Even though Russia supports Assad and supports his rule in Syria, you've got the Middle East, these allies of the United States, that realize they have to work with him and they have to deal with him.
It's remarkable. One little point in what you just said that it just occurred to me, is this really like the first time that Iran has been treated as kind of a legitimate power. This is kind of post U.S. nuclear deal. And now here it is sitting at the negotiating table with the rest of the countries.
Yeah, this is the first time that they've been there.
And it's Russia that,
That asked for it. And the United States, while they were upset about this, well, not they didn't want Iran there a couple of years ago. Now you can probably see them being, well, you know, look what the nuke deal, you know, allowed. Now we have Iran at the table negotiating with Western powers. Isn't this what we wanted?
Right.
Well, obviously the U.S. is going to come out on the bad side of this. And everybody knows it. As well, everybody knows that Russia is not going to back down in their will to leave Assad in power, at least for a while. This is what Prince Turki Al-Faisal of Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, ambassador to Washington, this is what he wrote. This is in this article in the Trumpet Weekly. He says, Putin is a man who has done so much to harm innocent people throughout the area in Syria. But I must also consider that he is head of a state, and that state is a big state, and he feels that state should have a decision-making role in the world. This is a Saudi Arabian former ambassador. And then he continued, and we have to deal with him. It's not that you ignore him or cast him off as a megalomaniac. He has a vision of the world and a strategy to put that vision in place.
It's amazing. Amazing statement.
They just realize the real politicking going on here. If they want their will, they're going to have to deal with Russia or accommodate Russia in some way. This used to be not like this in the Middle East. As long as they had the United States providing them with arms, backing up their positions, being anti-Iran, the Gulf states didn't feel like they had to make such maneuvers to one of their enemies or overtures towards their enemies. But now they realize, huh, I'm in a bad position. We're going to have to deal with Russia.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is in an especially difficult position, knowing the alliance between Russia and Iran and the alignment between those two nations, and Saudi Arabia has positioned it so strongly as the counterweight to Iran in the region, more and more as the United States has kind of allowed Iran to rise to power. So now here, where do they sit on this issue? It's a real challenge.
It is very difficult for them. Now, I think that the Saudi Arabians and even the Turks, they're probably hoping that Russia isn't as infatuated with Iran than the United States is right now. They're probably hoping that Russia at some point doesn't want to bolster Iran too much, so they're going to go in there and talk with Russia to see if, you know, there's a possible pluses to come out of this.
One other story I'd like you to cover, this is this Business Insider story from the Trumpet Weekly.
Right. This shows that Putin definitely does mean business. Last week, one of the Russian Navy's, their flagship from the Black Sea, the guided missile cruiser, the Moscow, that left Crimea on September 24th, actually, but it's right now it's off the coast of Latakia inside Syria. Now, this is a big game changer for Syria because aboard that cruiser it's armed with S-300 missiles, and they are able to shoot down aircraft, which, you know, has pretty much scared off the Israelis. They have to take that into account when they're going to do their bombing raids in northern Lebanon. And even if they have to move into Syria, they're going to have to watch out for the Russians because these missiles have a range of 150 miles. So if you're going to fly over that area, you have to be ready to potentially face an attack from Russia. Now, this is interesting because the Syrian rebels have been calling for the United States to impose a no-fly zone over Syria. This would mean Syrian aircraft would stop flying over Syria and bombing their own people. But the United States has not been able to do it or not been willing to do it. Now we have a Russian cruiser just sitting off the coast in the Mediterranean. It's virtually accomplished that. Nobody is going to be flying over that area, apart from the aircraft that the Russians allow.
Cold, hard evidence of Russia's seriousness and Russia's power in this situation. And as this article brings out, the Israelis, basically, they're having to say, we do not want to provoke the Russians. We have to be careful about how we go about our business because we got to stay clear of these guys. And the United States, I think we were talking earlier about just how the United States has essentially recognized Russia's no-fly zone by saying, well, we want to stay out of the airspace. If Russia is flying around, we're just going to kind of steer clear of them. And it sounds very cooperative. It sounds like they're just trying to, you know, we can work together in this. But really, the reality is Russia just said, no, you don't come over here. And the United States said, yes, sir.
Exactly right. That's it's amazing the power shift that's taken place there in the past couple of months. It's huge. Now, the end game for Russia is something that we need to consider as well, because we've been watching for a different power to take over in Syria, not the Russians. So that is something we're trying to figure out how that is going to happen. And there is just one more story I'd like to mention in the Trumpet Weekly that does show that this alliance between Russia and Iran probably isn't, you know, this lover relationship that they're going to be together forever. It's kind of a shaky alliance. It's interesting and important to look back at the history of Syria. And we talked earlier about Russia wanting to revamp its Soviet ambitions underneath Putin. He talked about the collapse of the Soviet Union being the greatest catastrophe geopolitically that occurred in the 20th century. And what we have here in Syria is the knowledge that for the 4 decades leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, the main control player in Syria was Russia. Russia supported Syria for those 4 decades economically, militarily, more than Iran. They weren't even a player. Putin wants his empire back. And to get that back, he's going back to what they had previously. And Syria was a big part of that in the Middle East.
All right. Thank you, Brent. You're listening to our Week in Review program. And we're going to turn now to Richard from our UK office. Another interesting situation in an entirely different theater. And again, Russia is in the mix.
That's right. The Balkans are on the brink of an explosion, and we've not talked about this region much recently. But really, it is on the crossroads of so many of the crises of this modern world. Their economies have all been badly hit by the euro crisis and by all the turmoil that's been going on in Greece. Then a huge number of the migrants coming to Europe coming through the Balkans, and so these are small countries having to deal with hundreds of thousands of migrants coming across them, and that's a huge strain. But the most important conflict here or crisis that affects them relates to our theme today, Putin. And the Balkans have long been the most volatile trigger point of conflict between Europe and Russia. So going all the way back to Otto von Bismarck, he famously predicted that Germany's next war with Russia would come from some fool thing in the Balkans. Sure enough, Germany used a conflict in the Balkans and the mesh of conflicting and tangled interests there to spark World War I. More recently, the collapse of Yugoslavia. That was a huge crisis in its own right, and that came close to bringing even NATO troops in direct conflict with Russian troops. And even today, then, the Balkans are still volatile. Europe wants them. They've got control over a lot of them. Croatia and Slovenia are part of the European Union now. But Russia still has deep influence there. And so the current strains in Europe's relationship with Russia could cause the Balkans now to explode. So that's the general background. One possible point of explosion that we talk about in the Trumpet Weekly is the Republika Srpska in Bosnia. And, I grew up in the 90s, and for me, the name Bosnia will now, you know, forever be connected as the epitome of violence and war, just because there just seemed like there was a year or two there where it was on the news every night, the suffering in Bosnia. 20 years ago, there was the Dayton Peace Agreement that put an end to this conflict by splitting Bosnia into two halves. There was the Bosniak-Croat majority, and then the Serbska Republic. And now this whole peace agreement is threatening to collapse. That could then reignite all that destructive conflict in Bosnia and perhaps even further afield across the Balkans. The Serbska is threatening to leave and to declare independence. And that could spark a major conflict much closer to Europe than Syria is. And then the Putin angle here is that the Serbs in Serbska are backed by Putin. And we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly called "Is War About to Break Out in the Balkans?" And it says here, Putin is able to create substantial problems for the West without needing to invest resources or diplomatic energy.
You know, it's interesting, just his involvement in the Balkans in this situation. It just reminds me of this this article that Gerald Fleury wrote. This was a May-June 2014 issue, Putin Remembers Yugoslavia. And he was basically talking about how the way that Europe dismantled Yugoslavia, which was formerly, Soviet-influenced, Soviet-aligned territory, the way that Europe dismantled that, that Putin remembers that, and he used that essentially as justification for what he did in Ukraine. So he's very aware of the situation. He's very aware of that region of the world and really does view it as somewhat of a battleground with Europe. And so here this article is making the point that he's doing this deliberately in order to try to create problems for Europe.
Absolutely. And I think that's the other reason that Putin's closely involved in this area that the article doesn't touch on, is that this whole region is a fantastic opportunity for him to expose the hypocrisy in the West and all of that hypocrisy that revolves around the breakup of Yugoslavia. And that was one of the things I really didn't like about this article we've got in the Trumpet Weekly. And really, I cut out as much of this as I could, but it's horribly biased against the Serbs. And to this author that wrote this article, the Serbs are, they're in the wrong. They're thoroughly, completely evil because they're threatening to break away from this multi-ethnic country and end a fragile peace and potentially trigger a destructive war. But that's exactly what the Croats did at the start of the 90s. That is exactly the same thing that triggered the Balkan Wars. The situations are so similar. Yet to this author and to so much of the Western world, the Croats are self-evidently the good guys, but when Serbs threaten to do exactly the same thing, it's completely beyond the pale, and they're the bad guys.
Well, that's the narrative that was promoted throughout the Balkans War, that the Serbs were the villains and the Croats were the good guys, and the formerly Nazi-aligned Croats. I mean, essentially, we accepted the European narrative of what was happening down there that played to their interests in taking over that part of the world.
Yes, and the hypocrisy just goes even further because this was the big accusation that a lot of people in Europe made when Russia took Crimea is that you don't go rewriting borders unilaterally in modern Europe. And there are that is a kind of a rule, and there are very good reasons for that. To give a kind of a brief history, Woodrow Wilson kind of set the modern borders of Europe, the path going for those with the Treaty of Versailles, with his principle of self-determination. Each ethnic group has a right to self-determination. Then you had Hitler come along and he exposed the weaknesses of that and said, well, if this is our guiding principle, then why can't Austria belong to Germany if they want to? What about Sudeten Germans living in Czechoslovakia? What about Germans in Poland? And then you had a whole bunch of other Eastern European nations claiming their ethnic minorities living in other countries, and it all dissolved into a horrible war. So after that, Europe said no rewriting of borders unilaterally. And yet that they violated exactly that principle in Yugoslavia. It was rewritten unilaterally without concern for the Serbs, without concern for Russia. And yet so often they turn around and point the same finger at Russia. So what Europe did in Yugoslavia was incredibly destabilizing for the peace, incredibly destructive, and it was wrong. Putin does the same thing. It's still wrong when Putin does it, but it also exposes the hypocrisy and the wrongness of what Europe did in Yugoslavia back in the 90s.
If there's one thing I could just interject here, we're talking a lot about the wrongs of what Europe did to Yugoslavia during that time period. I think we can be more specific about this because if you remember the history of what happened at that time, virtually the whole world, including America and Britain and many European nations like Italy and others, were actually against what the West and NATO actually did to Yugoslavia, at least initially. And it was Germany in particular and the Vatican that spearheaded that drive to dismember Yugoslavia. And if you recall, it was Germany that came out in the face of the whole world and recognized those breakaway republics of Croatia at that time. So just for our listeners to hear, if they want a little more background on this, we have a whole book that's available that they can get from the website, the trumpet.com website.
Germany conquers the Balkans.
Germany conquers the Balkans.
Right, and you really have to give Putin credit for drawing attention to the hypocrisy and using that as justification for what he's done. I mean, it's absolutely right. He's got a very, very strong case to make. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the Balkans now that you have this Serbian group that's trying to that declare independence, and they've got Putin behind them once again. Before we move on, I'd like to give you the opportunity, Richard, to talk about a few more of the headlines as we close our first segment. But one article in particular, this article about how Germany is rethinking its relationship with Russia.
Right. Well, one thing I'll just add before we move on completely on the Balkans is the that Srpska is just one of several areas that has the potential to be explosive. You've also got Montenegro. There's big protests going on there. Even last Sunday, there was a big protest there. They're wanting to join NATO, so that's another potential conflict with Russia. And then, yes, we have this article in the Trumpet Weekly called Germany Tests the Waters with Russia. And Germany's vice chancellor and economic minister, Sigmar Gabriel, he met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow just today. Putin was meeting with the former French president and potential future French president, Nicolas Sarkozy. So there's a softening in Europe's attitude towards Russia. And this article brings out that Germany may even be looking for ways to end EU sanctions on Russia. And it's quite possible that what is going on in the Balkans has a lot to do with that. They see that there's the potential for Russia to do some real damage for Europe. And so they're being forced to play nice.
Right. So it's certainly not because they think that Russia isn't so bad after all.
No, but I think that there are a whole bunch, and there's a whole bunch. It's amazing how many competing interests or intertangled interests Germany and Russia has, because it comes up in the Euro crisis with Russia's tentacles deep into Cyprus and even spreading into Greece. You've got oil and energy ties. So there are a lot tying these nations together as well. So they, even if they do not trust Russia, there's still quite a lot of reasons to come to an accord. And that's something that we've talked about on the Trumpet and that we've seen again over the last few hundred years, that there's this conflicting relationship of fear and mistrust, but also a lot of incentives to come to some kind of an agreement.
Thanks, Richard. Just real quick before we take a break, other European headlines of interest.
Yes, I thought I'd just one more thing is just update on the migrant crisis. It's still going on. Austria has said that they're going to build a border fence with Slovenia. So that's a fairly big deal. The fence isn't as big as Hungary's fence, but you know, the EU is meant to abolish exactly that kind of thing. And the migrant crisis is bringing that up. Germany then has announced that it's going to extend its border controls and keep those going on into November. And they're blaming Austria for not doing their part in stemming the flow of migrants to Germany. So this kind of like the Euro crisis, this migrant crisis is sowing discord and division within Europe and prompting a crisis that is going to force them to rethink how they do things. And then within Germany, it's rumored that the Christian Social Union, that party of Horst Seehofer, Edmund Stoiber and Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, it's rumored that they're threatening to make an unprecedented break with Angela Merkel's party unless their demands are met, and that they could even leave the coalition. And all of this is leading to more speculation about the future of Merkel. The Financial Times has an article this week called "The End of the Merkel Era is Within Sight." So there's a lot of political turmoil within Germany as well still.
All right, thanks, Richard. We've been talking a lot about Vladimir Putin all program, but we haven't even officially gone to Asia yet. Coming up, we're going to look at important news from Asia and America, and later on our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. And we're going to turn now to Asia and Jeremiah Jacques.
Well, first up is yet another story about Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. On Wednesday, he said that he wants to axe the U.S. dollar from all Russian trade, domestically and internationally. This has long been on the Kremlin's agenda, but it's not an easy task to accomplish. But now Putin is saying that he really wants to make it a higher priority for Russia.
And then next, we've got a China story here. On Wednesday, China rebuked the United States for sending a destroyer close to one of Beijing's man-made islands, which was there in the South China Sea. This island is hundreds of miles from the Chinese mainland, so international law says that it does not belong to China, even if they've built it there. But China gives about as much heed to international law about maritime operations as it does to cyber espionage laws. So this just really heightens the tensions there in the South China Sea a little bit more.
All right, and the top story from Asia this week.
Well, the big story is that the Russia-China relationship is developing into a Eurasian colossus. And it's something that the West should be very concerned about. That's the assessment of an article that we published by The National Interest. This piece was written by Lyle Goldstein. He's a professor at the China Maritime Studies Institute, and he does a powerful job of just bringing the reader up to speed about this budding colossus, Russia and China. Goldstein says that signs of a steadily enhancing Russia-China partnership are now undeniable. They're just ubiquitous. The two presidents recently attended each other's deeply significant victory celebrations, while Western leaders opted not to. He details the way China has lended rhetorical support to all of Russia's operations in Ukraine and more recently in Syria. He also discusses the fact that more and more Western analysts are now seriously concerned that the Russia-China relationship is evolving into a full-up military political alliance. And so there are many really compelling details in this article just proving that Russia and China are coming together in a powerful way. But I wanted to call attention to one quote from it. He says, Western strategists are right to watch this relationship closely, since a major strengthening of Russia-China relations could develop into the Eurasian colossus, albeit with two capitals rather than one, that geopolitics gurus have been warning about. So this detail about two capitals rather than one is worth calling attention to, I think, because it really agrees with what Bible prophecy says about this Eurasian, Russia-China-led bloc. The Bible talks about three different end-time power blocs. There's the King of the North, sort of a unified Europe led by Germany. There's the King of the South, which is the Middle Eastern radical Islamic power led by Iran. And then there is the Eastern power, which the Bible calls the kings of the East. So the language is a little bit different. For the King of the North and the King of the South, it's singular, king. But for the Eastern, the Asian bloc, it's plural, kings. So we know that, you know, from the article that you discussed at the top of the hour, that Vladimir Putin is the primary personality behind this and that Moscow is the primary capital. But the Bible language does imply that China and possibly other Asian states that join the Kings of the East bloc will retain kind of a degree of autonomy, a national identity in a strong way as they lend their support to Vladimir Putin's Russia. So when Goldstein says that he thinks this Eurasian colossus will have two capitals rather than one, this really does seem to parallel what the Bible says of this prophesied Asian bloc.
Very interesting. Yeah, you could see even, say, a behemoth like India, like we talked about, I think it was last week, having a certain gravitational pull of its own in that. But when you look at the prophecies, Russia and China are the two that are really emphasized more than any other. Even though it is a prince of Rosh, it is one particular personality in terms of the individual who's driving it, there definitely are indications of both Russia and China having a massive presence in that entity. So we are always interested in just seeing this evidence of this coming together. Are there any other, can you just share maybe a couple more details from that article that kind of give us a sense of how that alliance is coming together, or what this man sees that makes him say this is a developing colossus?
Well, one thing that he does in this article, which pretty interesting, I think, is he calls attention to something that happened before World War II, which has sort of been swept under the rugs for quite a while. But it shows that even in the pre-World War II era, there were some significant indications of these two powerhouses. Although at the time China was not a powerful nation, but they were still leaning together. And that was that in the 4 years after the Nanjing massacre there in December of 1937, the Russians gave lots and lots of aircraft, 1,000 of their very precious jets with accompanying pilots to the Chinese. And so this was a lavish aid if you look at it from a sort of a Russian perspective. They could have really used those lots and lots of powerful military equipment there. They could have used that for everything that they were trying to do in Europe on the Western Front. But instead, they lent this to China. And this has kind of been swept under the rug because in the 60s, Russia and China had a kind of a border crisis there. A few times it erupted into war. So they haven't called that much attention to the fact that the Soviet Union had helped the Chinese a lot in this pre-World War II era. But now, though, they're very quickly making this a big talking point. Like, look, Russia and China have had this history where we've helped each other even as far back as World War II. So it's kind of a forgotten part of history that Beijing and Moscow are now dusting off and just trumpeting for the world to remember that.
You know, I was just thinking about the demographically, Russia is on the wane. It's a small country. What is it, 150 million or what's the population of Russia? Somewhere in that range. And then you have this just massive, most populous nation on the earth, 1.2 or 3 billion. And so there's a clear, when you look at them coming together, obviously China has a lot to offer in terms of manpower. What are just one or two of the other like major resources that they would be looking for in each other that would draw them close together?
Well, for China, a big part of it is energy. Right now, China is consuming resources at a rate that's just unprecedented on the globe and in history. And to fuel the rise of this gigantic nation, I think it's actually close to 1.4 billion at this point. But to fuel that rise, which a massive aspect of that rise is lifting the poor of China up to the middle class. They have the fastest growing middle class on the planet. And so a huge part of that is it just requires lots and lots of oil and natural gas. And Russia is incredibly wealthy in the currency of oil and natural gas. So that, I think, is one major thing. It's just supply and demand. The two are perfect counterparts when it comes to the energy that Russia has and would like to sell and that China needs and would like to buy.
And we've seen historically a lot of ideological alignment between these two communist nations as well. So something to keep our eyes on for sure. You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to turn now to Anglo-America, and Robert Morley will start with the overview.
Sure. Math and reading scores are out for Detroit public schools, and they are bad. They're terrible. They're horrible. Here's what the National Assessment of Education and Progress found. And if you're not already doing so, hold on to your hats, because I think you'll be shocked. Talking about scores in mathematics, they found that 96% of eighth graders were not proficient. When it came to reading, 93% of eighth graders were not proficient in reading. And they found these kind of scores across all the subjects. And it's very, very disturbing. And it's disturbing because if you're thinking that that is something that's just contained to Detroit, you're wrong, because this was a national assessment and they have the scores out for many cities across America. And this is what they found on a nationwide scale. Only 33% of public school eighth graders across America scored at proficient or better in reading in 2015, and only 32% scored proficient or better in mathematics. So yeah, something that, as parents, something we need to be very, very aware of. Moving on, there's also was another study that was released this week, and this was concerning population growth in the United States, and I found this extremely astounding. Didn't realize that this was going on to such a dramatic degree, but this study revealed that 75% of all population growth in the United States since 2000 has been from immigration. 75% of all population growth since 2000 has been from immigration. And if current growth rates hold, America is on track to accept more than 100 million immigrants over the next 50 years. So if you think about a country with a population of a little over 300 million, over the next 50 years, we're going to add a third of our population just through immigration. And there's huge implications in terms of America's culture and way of life and what we as a country consider important and what we value. There's big geopolitical implications from this, political and also prophetical too.
All right, and your top story this week?
The top story this week, getting back a little bit over to China as well, but it regards America. The IMF is said to have given this week China, quote, strong signs of reserve currency nod, according to Bloomberg News. The International Monetary Fund representatives have now told China that the yuan, their currency, is likely to join the fund's basket of reserve currencies very soon. And this is something that would make, you know, a lot of nations around the world much more comfortable in holding and using the yuan and including that within their currency reserves, and thus would be a strong step towards the Chinese yuan becoming much more of a reserve currency on the world scene. So the IMF, just for a little background, it issues what's called special drawing rights, which is basically an international currency that nations use on an international scale. And it's composed of a basket of currencies. And now what they're doing is they're going to bring the yuan into this basket of currencies for use. And so what we'll see from this, if this goes through, is it will dilute the dollar component in that basket of international currencies. So we'll just have to wait and see how much of the yuan is included, what its weighting is. But I think it's very interesting. Bloomberg brings out that by winning the IMF's endorsement, it would really validate all these efforts that President Xi Jinping has done to push through policies aimed at making China much more market-oriented. It'd be this big boost in prestige for him. And I think that it's really important not to overlook this, because it wasn't long ago that the U.S. was lobbying very strongly against China being able to join the IMF currency basket, joining these SDR special drawing rights. They were against that, just like they were against the recent Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank that is in the launch stage right now. And America was going door to door trying to drum up support to keep China out. They said this was not a good thing for world economy. It was not good for emerging markets. But now it looks like they have flip-flopped on this. We have the United States has caved. And I guess it's not too surprising, since pretty much the whole world was on board with China and against America. I think the only two nations that really came out on America's side were Japan and Canada. So here we are seeing the growth of power and influence in China in a very dramatic way.
And just the 20-second digested version of what happens if reserve currency status flips from U.S. to China or anyone else.
Right. Reserve currency status really is a huge blessing for America. It impacts everything from the low interest rates we're able to have. If you've ever recently gone to check out mortgages, we're paying between 3 and 4% for a mortgage. Historically, that's lower than it's ever been. Things like that are possible because of reserve currency status. The world needs dollars, and America can print them. As long as the world needs them and is forced to use them, America can print them. And that has huge impacts on our way of life and standard of living.
So we lose it, and suddenly dollars become a lot less
valuable.
Attractive.
That's right. Dollars become less valuable. Things start costing more. Borrowing costs go up. So there are a lot of knock-on effects from reserve currency status.
All right. Thanks, Robert. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're talking about on the program are in this report. It's a fantastic report. It's free. Go online and you can become a subscriber. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Brent.
The former Iranian president Rafsanjani admitted this week that the country's nuclear program was started with the intent of being able to build a nuclear weapon. Now, this was reported by some Iranian dissidents, so they're obviously against the regime. But even so, this is the quote that Rafsanjani said this week. He said, quote, "Our basic doctrine was peaceful usage of nuclear technology, although we never abandoned the idea that if one day we are threatened and it is imperative, we would have the capability for going the other path to a nuclear weapon as well." Now, these comments mark the first time that a top Iranian official, current or former, has said that the country has sought a nuclear weapon. And this is obviously in contravention of repeated assurances by the regime that its enrichment program is and always has been peaceful. That's what they said during the nuke talks that concluded in July, that they've never gone after a nuclear weapon. Although it seems here from the former president's mouth himself that was an option for them and a directly stated goal in the event that they would need it.
All right, thanks very much. Now to Richard.
Well, my story is basically a reminder that the Greek crisis is not fixed yet. If you remember where we left off, Greece had agreed to obey the European Union's diktats, implement the reforms that they wanted, and in return they would get a steady stream of cash. But Greece is already badly behind in implementing these reforms. They've only followed through on 14 out of 48 of them. And the Süddeutschland Zeitung is reporting that European creditors are planning to hold back the $3 billion or so that they were due to pay Greece this month. So if you're getting a feeling of deja vu now, that's because we've been exactly here before. This is pretty much the same situation we had at the start of this year. And it's a good illustration that this economic crisis is not solved. The showdown over the summer, where Germany beat Greece into submission, only brought a temporary reprieve. And pretty sure this is going to come to a head once again in Greece and maybe even before then in some other country, possibly Portugal, like we talked about last week.
All right. Thanks, Richard. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
A new Cold War could be developing deep under the sea. Virtually all of the world's information moves under the sea. You've got about 200 highly active cables. Some of these are as deep under the water as Mount Everest is tall. And about 95% of everything on the global internet passes through these cables. On a normal day, all of that information is safe and sound, is humming along. But reports this week show that the Russian Navy has been spending a lot of time lurking right around some of these cables. And all the indications are that they are collecting information about how they might be able to target them in the event of heightened tensions. So this would give... It would really give a rich trove of intelligence to the Russian Navy, and it would just be sort of a symbolic chest thump for Vladimir Putin.
On that big barrel chest of his. And right. Finally to Robert.
Well, we're seeing that containerized freight prices, as they measure the price to ship goods around the world, these prices are collapsing, and they've hit the lowest level they've ever had. These are prices out of China, China being the world's biggest trading nation. And we've written about this before. We've written about what's called the Baltic Dry Index, which has also hit near record lows. And what we're seeing is that prices of shipped goods are cascading, and that's because people aren't buying anymore. The global economy is shrinking. So we see that's the major issue going on here. There's also another issue tied into that, which is that there's a lot more boats plying the ocean than they used to, but it's still a strong indicator that the economy is not as good as we would all hope.
All right. Thank you, Robert. I wanted to talk about President Obama, who last Thursday, a week ago Thursday, he was at a White House criminal justice forum, and he defended the Black Lives Matter movement. He did praise the overwhelming majority of police who want to do the right thing, but he said that we need to address a specific problem that's happening in the African-American community that's not happening in other communities. Was he talking about the 72% out-of-wedlock birth rate in the Black community? No. He wasn't talking about the fact that blacks are 13% of the U.S. population, but about 50% of the homicide victims in the United States. He wasn't talking about the fact that over 90% of those victims are killed by other blacks. No, he was talking about the idea that an inordinate number of black suspects are shot by police officers. He said this, "We as a society, particularly given our history, have to take this seriously. And one of the ways of avoiding the politics of this and losing the moment is everybody just stepping back for a second and understanding that the African American community is not just making this up. It's not just something being politicized." So he says this isn't made up. It's not politicized. And this is something that it's a big deal. You know, at the Democratic debate a week ago, this was a question at the debate. Do black lives matter or do all lives matter? And essentially, this is becoming a way of proving whether or not you understand the plight of African Americans. If you say all lives matter, then you're proving that you just don't get it. So what is the specific problem the president is drawing attention to that isn't being made up, that isn't being politicized, he says? Well, the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Alicia Garza, says this. She says that it's about the idea that black lives are, quote, uniquely, systematically, and savagely targeted by the state. That's what this movement suggests. Is it true? Selwyn Duke wrote a column about this past week where he just looked at some of the statistics. In the last several decades, the numbers of blacks killed by cops are down nearly 75%. Over the 13-year period from 1999 to 2011, the CDC reports that 2,151 whites were killed by cops and 1,130 blacks were killed by cops. In 2012, according to the CDC, 140 blacks were killed by police. The same year, it was 386 whites killed by police. Relative to whites, blacks are shot by police at a lower rate than their involvement in crime would suggest. Sociologist and ex-cop Professor Peter Moskos writes that adjusted for the homicide rate, whites are 1.7 times more likely than blacks to die at the hands of police. Adjusted for the racial disparity at which police are feloniously killed, whites are 1.3 times more likely than blacks to die at the hands of police. There's a study here from Washington State University published online last year in the Journal of Experimental Criminology that discusses this. And one of the researchers, David Klinger, he's actually a former cop, and he wrote a book in 2006 called Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force. He said this, "When it comes to the issue of race, I've never had a single officer tell me I didn't shoot a guy because he was white. I've had multiple officers tell me I didn't shoot a guy because he was black. And the second thing is I've had multiple officers tell me they were worried in the wake of a shooting because they shot a black person. And I've had multiple officers tell me that they were glad that the person that they shot was white." It's not too difficult to understand why this would be the case, given the very high-profile incidents where when blacks are targeted or when blacks end up being shot by police, then it becomes a highly politicized, big media circus. No police officer would want to put himself into that situation. But what's interesting is to just listen to the spokesman, the co-founder of this movement, Garza. She admitted that the Black Lives Matter was an organized movement, that it bussed 500 protesters into Ferguson. It was designed to be, quote, a platform also to re-energize radical politics in the black community. In one protest in Chicago, rabble-rousers took down an American flag and replaced it with an unapologetically black flag. In Georgia, a Black Lives Matter activist currently faces charges of criminal solicitation and terroristic threats for waving a gun and a machete in videos and asking blacks to take police officers' guns, take over a police station, and kill white people. There was a march in Manhattan and Minnesota where rabble-rousers were chanting that they wanted dead cops, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon. This is what is coming out of that movement. And this is the organization that the president defended at a criminal justice forum last week in the White House. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We're also on Twitter @thetrumpet_com or Facebook, Google Plus. Just search for the Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
You're welcome. Pleasure
to be welcome.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Elbert Hubbard: to avoid criticism, do nothing, say nothing, and be nothing. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.